Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 4, Text 11, Text 10, Translation and Commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Translation, he was a great emperor, this is referring to Parikshit Maharaj. He was a great emperor and possessed all the opulences of his acquired kingdom. He was so exalted that he was increasing the prestige of the Pandu dynasty. Why did he give up everything to sit down on the bank of the Ganges and fast until death? Purport, Maharaj Parikshit was the emperor of the world and all the seas and oceans, and he did not have to take the trouble to acquire such a kingdom by his own effort. He inherited it from his grandfathers, Maharaj Yudhishthira and brothers. Besides that, he was doing well in the administration and was worthy of the good names of his forefathers. Consequently, there was nothing undesirable in his opulence and administration. Then, why should he give up all these favorable circumstances and sit down on the bank of the Ganges fasting till death? This is astonishing, and therefore all were eager to know the cause. This is astonishing, and therefore all were eager to know the cause. That is the last sentence in this purport. All refers to Shonaka Rishi and his attendant 60,000 rishis. 60,000, I presume that's approximate, they didn't count one by one. The Shonaka Rishi and 59,999. Approximately 60,000, just like you see in the... There's so many thousand pillar temples in South India. Have you seen? In South India, thousand pillar temples. Most of them have less than 1,000 pillars. It would be 700, 800, something like that. In Rameshwaram, it's more than 1,000. It's still there called 1,000. So, all were eager. What were they eager to know? Many people are eager to know many things. You may be eager to read the newspaper and try to understand who is likely to be the next president of the United States. This will fill up the news until sometime in November, probably. We're all eager to learn about various factors and facets of this material world. Parikshit Maharaj was the most important person in the world at the time. This was shortly before Shonakadi Rishi were inquiring from Suta Goswami. So it was recent history at the time. Now, just to hypothesize, and this is a big hypothesis, if George Bush or Bill Clinton... No, wait a minute, what's that? Bill Gates, sorry. Or Bill Clinton, also. Were to suddenly go to the bank of the Mississippi or whatever and sit and fast until death, people would want to know why. Because you don't expect George Bush to do that. Or Bill Clinton, or Bill Gates. Because they've got everything going for them, of course. George Bush is on the way out, but he'll still be a big figure in the world even after he passes out of the office, until he passes out of the body. Then he'll become a... Anyway, I won't say that, I might get into trouble. I might drop a bomb on me or something. So, you can just... You see, if some, you know, tuppence halfpenny person, that's an old English saying, it means a completely insignificant person, decides to renounce his home. Who cares? There are so many sadhus in India. And it seems that many of them become sadhus because, you know, it's an easier way to make a living. Not so much headache as having to maintain a family. So they become renounced and they wander from holy place to holy place. And Pious people, no doubt, they have some religious tendency. But it's understood that their religious tendency or their renunciation is much enhanced by the fact that it's better for them to be a renunciate than a responsible household. It's an easier way of life. It's an easy way out for them. It has been observed that in poor countries like India, one reason that so many people join our temples as brahmacharis is because they have a better life in the temple than outside it. Their standard of living immediately zooms up. They get better food and with less work, and live in a better building and better facilities, and people even respect them for it. Whereas outside, they're just a nobody, and everyone figuratively kicking them in the head and struggling to just get a few chapatis to eat, and they're not even as tasty as the ones cooked in ISKCON. So, I'm not saying everyone's like that, but it's definitely a factor among poor people that the renounced life may be a better life than the apparently non-renounced life or the attached life. But Parikshit Maharaj wasn't like that. He had everything going for him. He was rich. What was the extent of his riches? He ruled over the whole world. And naturally, along with that came fame. And he also had a good reputation. I mean, it's not, we use the example of George Bush, and apart from people who are dogmatically Republican supporters, Republican Party, he doesn't have a very good reputation. People don't think he's a very good person. I doubt even if people love him. Maybe his wife loves him, dog loves him, and maybe a few diehard Republicans love him. But actually, the kings of former times, they were loved by their citizens. They were considered the protectors. There was a great reciprocation between the citizens and the king. And even in Thailand, up to the present time, even though the present king has no explicit political power, nor does he have, but still he's very much loved by his people, feeling that he's our king, and we like being Thais, and we love him. So he was loved, he had his wife and family. His wife's name was, anyone? Iravati, I think it was. You don't hear much about her. She's probably a quiet and submissive lady. So he was powerful, respected, rich, and no doubt good-looking, as Srila Prabhupada comments in one place. The Kshatriyas, both men and women, usually have very good bodily features, good-looking, more than the Brahmins, in general. Physical strength, reputation, just by being born in the family of the Pandavas, he had a tremendous reputation. And his reputation was such that he, Pandunam Manavardhana, he had increased the prestige of the Pandavas, which is a very difficult thing to do, considering that the Pandavas, they're famous even up to the present day. At least in India, the word Pandava, most Hindus at least. Well, in the modern generation, they know the names of cricket players more, but Pandava is still among pious Hindus, those who take some interest in their culture. The word Pandava, even up to today, is well known. Why are they well known? Well, they are the principal characters in the Mahabharata. And they are the principal characters in the Mahabharata because of their ideal character. They all represent facets of ideal character. Just like a common term also among Hindus is Ram Raja. They consider the idea of a kingdom ruled by Ram, that is the ideal. So, although Yudhishthira Maharaj was certainly not the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as is Lord Ram, but in terms of ruling the kingdom, his rule was on the same par, the same level. He was an ideal king. And Parikshit Maharaj was such a great person that he increased the prestige and reputation of the Pandavas, of the dynasty. The Pandavas appeared. He didn't just maintain, but he increased. Such was his status. But he left it all. Why? Why would anyone leave such a situation? This is the question of Shaunaka Rishi. And the answer will be given in the upcoming narration. Why did he do that? Actually, there's a gap, isn't there? Doesn't it? It's not answered immediately. We have to get round to towards the end of the canto to find out the answer. But what is the answer? Because Parikshit Maharaj was self-realized, and he understood that all these material facilities are of no actual value, and that there is something far more valuable, which is to search out Krishna, to find Krishna. So he was living according to the prescription of the verse, which was the subject of my lecture last night. That we have obtained this human form of life after many, many births. It's temporary, it's not going to last long. So Parikshit Maharaj, we have considered that, well, even if I don't give it up now, I'm going to have to give it up anyway, very soon. So before the body falls down, one should perform those activities by which one will not have to take birth again. And if we think, well, I can enjoy sense gratification, that's more important, and we are reminded that we have enjoyed sense gratification in many species of life prior to this, and we can continue doing so in future lives if we don't take this opportunity of human life. So we see that most people are reluctant to give up even a very petty level of sense gratification. Parikshit Maharaj had a level of sense gratification which is not even imaginable by anyone in the world today, even Bill Gates, who's got so much money. He can't imagine having the same level of sense gratification. And another factor is that people, even up until recently, what to speak of at that time, they're very healthy bodies. Whereas in the modern age, pretty much no one has a very healthy body. Even if you see someone who looks like they're healthy, like an Olympic athlete, it doesn't take long before they get all kinds of aches and pains and AIDS and cancer. It doesn't last, their so-called healthy body. But Parikshit Maharaj was very healthy, very strong. Kshatriyas, they were strong, physically strong. So there's another advantage. But he considered that more important to find out Krishna. He said that all this or all that, that's not very important. Let's hear from Shukadeva Goswami. Let me find out the solution to the miseries of material life. He was enlightened enough to realize that all these advantages, they're actually the cause of misery. As Lord Krishna states in Bhagavad Gita, what's that verse? Yehi samsparsha jabhoga dukha yonya evate adyanta vanta kaunte anateshu ramate buddha. Srila Prabhupada, in the English translation, uses this phrase, the causes of misery that the pleasure derived from the interaction of the senses with the sense objects is actually beginning, middle, and end simply a cause of misery, and therefore an intelligent person does not take part in it. For a person who thinks that his facilities for sense enjoyment are an advantage, they're actually like a weight dragging him down. He thinks it's an advantage, but it's actually a disadvantage, because it prevents us from inquiring into the actual purpose of life. We take this little pleasure, the little pleasure of sense gratification, as being my life's goal. That's the motto of Croatia. I mean, this whole country exists. Its economy runs, and the main bulwark of its economy is providing facilities for sense gratification. I mean, the sun and the sand, which are considered so much relishable by people in countries like Sweden and Germany, where they don't get much sun, and I guess the sand, I guess not. You know, you always go to the Baltic Sea when you can come to the Adriatic Sea. It's more relishable for sense gratification. So people come all the way, get stuck in traffic jams in the Alpine tunnels, and cursing in German or whatever on their way, just to lie on the beach with 50,000 other stool pakoras. In the words of Saroja Maharaj, who is very expert at analyzing the condition of the material world. And this country's economy exists on that. I mean, it's the main support of that. The idea that we shall be happy. I will be happier lying on the beach in Croatia than I will be sitting in my little industrial town in Germany, lying on the lawn in my apartment block. It's better to come to fruition. But it's a cause of distress, beginning, middle, and end. The little happiness you might get from having the sun shine on your body is soon counteracted by having sunburn, and maybe even skin cancer, if you know. It's also possible. And what to speak of that drive back to Germany, getting stuck in the Alpine tunnels again, 50-kilometer traffic jam, which is normal at this time of year, with the prospect of having to go back to your factory. So, this is a very miserable kind of life, which people think is relishable. Foolishly, people think this is relishable. But Parikshit Maharaj, his level of sense gratification was so much greater. He was a lot more intelligent, too. Not just materially, but spiritually, had the discrimination to understand that there is happiness far beyond the happiness of driving from Germany to Croatia and back, far beyond that of having mystic powers like astral travel. Last night, the young lady was asking about astral travel. Far beyond that of being the ruler of the whole world, undisputed ruler of the world, and having a good reputation, even having a good reputation, that is considered something worth having. I shall live on even after I die. They will make a statue of me. Someone will write a biography about me. These are the desires of persons who desire to be well known even after they've died. But there is something, the point here is that there's something far more valuable than any of these things, and that is to reestablish our eternal relationship with Krishna. So this is a very good introduction to the Bhagavata, the practical demonstration of the principles which have been outlined in the beginning three chapters, that we see in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, the absolute necessity of Krishna consciousness is outlined, for instance, in verses such as Shama Eva He Kevalam. That's a good example, isn't it? What's the beginning of that verse? Shrama Eva He Kevalam. Yes. Even if one is very dharmic, even if one follows, even if one's a very pious person, if one doesn't gain a taste for hearing about Krishna, then it's simply a waste of time. So one may be considered a sweeping statement. You know what a sweeping statement is? It means like, it means just like brush everything out of the sand. Everything is useless. Big kingdom, useless. Lying on the beach, useless. Astral travel, useless. Having your dog win the dog show, useless. Passing the most fragrant stool in the whole of Croatia. Oh, did they start a competition yet? The fragrant stool passing competition. They have so many kinds of competition. Special Olympics for people, you know, they can't run, but they can roll their wheelchair faster than someone else. So they all, so everything is just swept out of the way. Sweeping statement. It seems like some kind. It seems to be something like, believe in Jesus, sinners, or burn in hell forever. So it may seem like that, such a statement. But then the whole Bhagavatam supports this philosophically and gives examples. Parikshit Maharaj isn't the only example. Bharat Maharaj is another example of a king of the whole world who just left it all. Rishabh, his father, did the same. Dhruva Maharaj is a different example who comes to the same conclusion that he did want a great kingdom, but then when he got it, he thought, it's useless. I should have just been Krishna conscious from the beginning. So, Bhagavatam introduces us to our relationship with Krishna, which is available to everyone. It's not just for Parikshit Maharaj or Dhruva Maharaj, but it's available for everyone. And the examples are given of great kings like Parikshit Maharaj because they had so much material happiness and still they left it so that they could become Krishna conscious. Then what to speak of us? We have a little petty sense gratification. We may have a little petty sense gratification. We think, well, it's not much, so I might as well try to become Krishna conscious. But if I got a lot more sense gratification, then it might be worth trying it out. See how you can be a religious and a sadhu, because I don't have much choice. I mean, there's not much else going on for me in this life anyway. Just like someone said to me earlier, a few months ago, that they're trying to get a job. So I said, well, what if you don't get a job? Then I'll join the temple. It's like, you know, it's like a second best alternative. You know, it's like, I'll try and be a material success. If it doesn't work out, well, I can always join the temple. So the examples of Parikshit Maharaj are valuable because Parikshit Maharaj, he didn't have any better position to aspire for. When he lies down to go to sleep at night, he's not going to daydream about, well, if I was the king of the world, because he is the king of the world. He's not going to daydream about something that I could obtain because he already had everything. And such a person found it insignificant. So this is the important lesson to be understood here. Is there any question about this? Yeah, that's your question.
I was thinking about we already somehow surrendered.
We surrendered.
On one level.
On one level we surrendered. All right.
So, how is possible that...
This is the Tengalai Vadigalai question. You surrender once, or you have to go on surrendering?
How is this dynamic?
Well, well-known word, again, this word used to be well-known in India, but it's largely forgotten now, along with most of the rest of the culture. The well-known word is Sharanagati. Sharanagati means the way of taking shelter. So it's understood when one takes to the process of Krishna consciousness that he's not Krishna conscious. Otherwise we wouldn't have to take to the path of Krishna consciousness. So it means that we're trying, we're on the way. We've made the decision that my life's purpose is to surrender to Krishna fully. But I'm not there yet. So in one sense we're surrendered because we made the decision to go on that path. But on the other hand, we're not fully there because we're still inhibited by so many material desires and attachments which take some time to overcome. So yes, we are surrendered. But on the other hand, it's not the we haven't attained the full position of surrender. So we're in the sadhana dasha, this situation of active engagement in Krishna consciousness, with the aim of coming to the platform of pure Krishna consciousness. Anything else?
Okay, the fact that we are here now is that we didn't get chance or deserve in previous life or the life before to go home. And isn't the fact that we are now here, why we talk with sarcasm to other people who trying who didn't get the chance to come in Krishna consciousness? For example, the people who try in wheelchair to be in competition, because for me, I think that is better the guy who, I don't know, he get a car accident and he is now in a wheelchair, somehow on a spiritual level to be in competition that in, I don't know, putting needle in their hand and die with the drugs or to be miserable all his life. Why we can't...
Why criticize others? As we ourselves are... We ourselves are in a lamentable position. We are not Krishna conscious. And why criticize others? For instance, why criticize the wheelchair inhabitant for racing in his wheelchair? He's spiritually racing his wheelchair? You said something like that?
Somebody who didn't give up on his life.
He didn't give up his life. He could have committed suicide. That's true of everyone.
Somehow, because
he's going on. He has some spirit to make a mark for himself in the world. Yeah, well, the point is it's all useless. That's the whole point of the whole class, is that every endeavor in this world, it all begins and ends, everything is miserable. So the attempt to make our situation laudable when it is lamentable is even more lamentable. And the example of the Special Olympics is particularly to the point, because the position of someone in a wheelchair is obviously it's handicapped. That's what it's already the chances of material enjoyment are to a large extent quashed. Or then someone who has a healthy body, they have an opportunity for material enjoyment. Someone who has a crippled body, his opportunity with material enjoyment is severely handicapped. That's why they used to call them handicapped. They used to call them, first of all, they called them spastics, and then they called them physically handicapped, and now they're physically challenged. And when that becomes a pejorative term, you know what that means, like a bad word, then they'll invent some other term. It's like they were Negroes, and then they became Black Americans, and now they're Afro-Americans. They keep on changing the term, because the idea is that you shouldn't call them anything bad. But then the new term that you use, that becomes a bad term, because it's not the word you use, it's the implication or the attitude that goes with it. So this example is particularly fitting, because you can see, just like if someone has a healthy body, then it might seem appropriate for them to try to get sense gratification. But for someone who his sense gratification is curtailed almost completely, to still try to show himself, I'm better than the other crippled people, I'm the best of the crippled, it's particularly bizarre, and therefore serves as a good example of the uselessness of the endeavor to enjoy sense gratification by anybody. So that's the reason. It's for philosophical purposes. We don't hate crippled people, but we don't mind to point out so that our understanding of our position may be enhanced. We don't mind to point out the crippled mentality of people within this material world, so that we ourselves can be free from it, and we can point out. Otherwise, how are we going to point? If we just say to people, they come and say, well, actually, everything you're doing is wonderful, they'll feel nice, but they won't get any benefit, because what they're doing is not wonderful. That's what we're preaching. That is the fact. We may say, you're wonderful, everything is nice, you're such a great person, and they'll feel, okay, great, I like it. But that doesn't free them from birth and death. If we point out that all your endeavors are useless, you may be a big shot in this material world, you may be an Olympic champion, or you may be a tennis star, that you were telling me. The people in India, they know Croatia now because of some tennis star. They heard the name, and because the football team. So now they've heard of Croatia. So you may be famous, you may be a popular football star, but it's all meaningless. It's all useless. The only thing meaningful is to revive our eternal relationship with Krishna. That is the point. Anything else? As long as we're thinking there's anything desirable within this material world, then we won't have the impetus to become Krishna conscious. All right, Hare Krishna, Srimad Bhagavatam.